Okay, so get this. Imagine, like, your ancestors owned this huge piece of land, but over time, it shrinks down to basically nothing. Then, you start buying pieces of it back.
Right.
Would that mean you suddenly rule it again?
It's a question that really gets right to the core of like tribal sovereignty
Yeah,
and land rights.
for sure.
And it's kind of exactly what the Supreme Court had to deal with in that
Yeah.
City of Sherrill v. Oneida Indian Nation case.
So we're gonna deep dive into that case today.
That's right.
We've got like actual court documents and some really interesting legal analysis.
Absolutely.
It's a story full of history, twists and turns, and it brings up some like thought-provoking questions about how land ownership and sovereignty actually work.
Yeah, what's fascinating about this case is that it forces us to think about
Yeah.
the limits of historical claims when they bump up against like modern day realities.
So let's start by kind of painting a picture of the situation.
Okay.
The Oneida Nation originally had a massive territory.
Right.
I mean, we're talking 6 million acres in New York.
Wow.
By 1920, it was down to just 32 acres.
That's a staggering loss.
That's a huge loss. What happened?
Well, it's a complex story,
Yeah.
with forced cessions, treaties that weren't always honored, and frankly, land grabs
Yeah.
by the state and federal governments. All of that kind of chipped away at the United Nations territory over time.
So fast forward to the late 1990s, the Oneida Nation starts buying back land within their original territory. They're exercising their right to buy property, just like anyone else.
Absolutely. There was nothing legally questionable about them purchasing the land at
Right.
all.
But then the city of Sherrill, which happens to be located within this territory, says,
Yeah.
hold on, you owe us property
Yeah,
taxes.
and that's where the spark hits the gasoline, right?
Yeah.
The United Nations argues this is sovereign land. We don't answer to you when it comes to taxes.
Yeah.
They're pointing to the general principle that
Wow.
tribal sovereignty often comes with tax immunity.
It seems pretty straightforward on the surface, right?
Yeah.
They bought the land fair and square. It was originally part of their territory, so why not?
Well, the lower courts initially agreed
Yeah.
with the Oneida Nation
Okay.
upholding their claim to tax immunity.
Okay.
It seemed like a clear victory.
But then the Supreme Court.
And things took a very dramatic turn. The Supreme Court reversed those lower court decisions
Wow.
with an 8-to-1 ruling
Yeah.
against the Oneida Nation.
Wow, that's a pretty decisive rejection.
It is.
What was the Supreme Court's reasoning?
So the core issue wasn't actually about whether the Oneida Nation owned the land.
Right.
They clearly did.
Yeah.
The legal battle was about whether simply buying back that land
Right.
automatically flipped a switch
Yeah.
and revived their sovereignty over it after 200 years of non-tribal governance.
So even though they had like a historical claim
Yeah.
and legally owned the land,
Right.
the court said that doesn't mean their sovereignty automatically like snapped back into place.
Exactly. Time in this case, really complicated the legal arguments.
Yeah.
Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion,
Okay.
and she acknowledged the inherent right of tribal sovereignty.
Okay.
But she also stressed the practical consequences of trying to rewind history after two centuries.
What kind of practical consequences?
Well, think about it. You've got towns, cities, all sorts of infrastructure,
Yeah.
property taxes, funding local governments, zoning laws. All deeply entrenched in that land,
Yeah.
suddenly shifting jurisdiction back to the Oneida Nation after all that time.
It was complete and utter chaos, and you're
Right.
starting to see their point.
You're getting it.
Yeah.
That potential for major disruption was a key concern for the court.
Right.
And to support their decision, they leaned on three legal doctrines: latches, acquiescence, and impossibility.
Okay, break those down for me, starting with latuches.
Okay.
What does that even mean?
So latuta basically means that if you wait too long
Yeah.
to assert a right,
Right.
you might lose the ability to enforce it.
Yeah.
In this case, the court pointed out that the Oneida Nation waited over 200 years
Wow.
from 1805 to 1997 to make this claim of sovereignty.
So it's almost like a use it or lose it principle, but applied to sovereignty.
That's a good way to think about it.
Okay.
The longer you wait,
Yeah.
the harder it might be
Yeah.
to reassert a right that hasn't been actively exercised.
Okay.
Then you have acquiescence,
Right.
which means that by not challenging a situation for a very long time, you basically accepted it.
Yeah.
The court argued that the Oneida Nation, by not asserting sovereignty earlier, had essentially acquiesced to state jurisdiction over that land.
Okay, so we've got waiting too long
and
implicitly accepting the situation. What about impossibility? Does that mean it's like literally impossible to undo 200 years of non-tribal governance?
It might not be literally impossible, but the court argued that it would be so disruptive, so impractical to try to untangle everything, that it would be effectively impossible to restore sovereignty over that land without causing serious problems.
So the court's message was something like, we understand you have historical claims, but too much time has passed.
Yeah.
Things have changed, and we can't just upend everything now.
You've nailed it.
Okay.
Justice Ginsburg's opinion really focused on this idea of balancing historical rights with the need for stability and clear lines of jurisdiction in the present day.
But hold on a second. I thought you said there was a dissenting opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Justice Stevens wrote a fiery dissent, and he did not hold back.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting. What did Justice Stevens have to say?
Justice Stevens argued that the majority opinion was basically turning, you know, Indian law on its head.
Yeah.
He was adamant that only Congress has the power to diminish reservations or tribal tax immunity, not the court.
So he saw it as a power grab.
Right? Exactly. So the Supreme Court was like stepping on Congress's toes. Like, hey, you guys are overstepping your bounds. You know, Congress makes the rules about tribal sovereignty, not you.
I got it. Stevens accused the majority of essentially usurping congressional authority.
Okay.
He felt they were letting worries about, you know, potential disruption trump foundational legal principles.
Yeah.
And he argued that policy decisions about how to balance those competing interests should be left to lawmakers, not the courts.
It sounds like Justice Stevens thought the court was so afraid of, like, rocking the boat.
That they were willing to sacrifice important tribal rights in the process.
That's a very astute reading of his dissent.
Okay.
He really believed the court prioritized maintaining the status quo over what he saw as a clear violation of the Oneida Nation's inherent sovereignty.
It's fascinating how one case can expose such fundamentally different views on the law.
Hmm.
So we've got Ginsburg advocating for, you know, stability.
Right.
And Stevens championing tribal rights.
Yeah.
Were any of the other justices on Stevens' side? Was it really just eight against one?
Not quite. Justice Souter, while agreeing with the majority's outcome, wrote a separate concurring opinion that brought a whole other layer of nuance to the discussion.
Okay, let's explore Souter's perspective.
Okay.
What made his opinion different?
He agreed that the Oneida Nation couldn't just revive their sovereignty after such a long period of state jurisdiction. But his reasoning zeroed in on something really interesting.
Okay.
The passage of time itself.
So not just that they took too long to make their claim, but something more profound about how time impacts sovereignty.
Precisely. Souter argued that those 200 years of non-tribal governance didn't just create practical problems for restoring sovereignty.
Right.
He suggested it actually eroded the very legal basis for that sovereignty to exist at all.
Whoa, that's a pretty bold statement.
It
is. Is he saying that, like, time can actually change the legal reality of sovereignty?
That's certainly how I interpret his concurrence.
Yeah.
He's suggesting that sovereignty isn't just a light switch you can flip on and off. It's something that can be weakened, maybe even extinguished.
Wow.
By the passage of time and the continuous exercise of state jurisdiction.
It's mind-blowing. Like, even though he agreed with the overall decision, Souter's reasoning was fundamentally different from Ginsburg's.
Right.
It wasn't just about, you know, potential disruption.
Right.
He was implying that sovereignty itself had, like, faded over time.
You've hit the nail on the head.
Wow.
And this distinction is so important because it adds a whole new dimension to our understanding of how time, sovereignty, and jurisdiction interact.
It makes you wonder what this means for other tribes, right?
Yeah.
In similar situations.
Yeah.
Is there now a ticking clock on their sovereignty?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And it goes straight to the heart of this case's impact.
Okay.
While the Sherrill decision didn't create a hard and fast legal test.
Right.
It did establish a framework
okay.
for how courts should handle similar disputes.
So it kind of blueprint, right?
Yeah.
For navigating these tricky questions of time and sovereignty, what exactly does this framework include?
The court highlighted four key factors to consider. First, there's the duration of state jurisdiction.
Okay.
How long has the land been under non-tribal control?
Right.
As we've seen, the longer it's been, the yeah. harder it becomes for a tribe to reassert sovereignty.
200 years in the Oneida case.
Exactly.
Definitely not in their favor.
Right.
What's the second factor?
Second, there's tribal delay.
Yeah.
Did the tribe wait too long
yeah.
to assert their sovereignty? Again,
right.
longer delays weaken their claim.
Okay, that makes sense. What else do courts have to, like, think about?
The third factor is the risk of disruption.
Okay.
Would recognizing tribal sovereignty significantly upend the existing mm-hmm. systems of governance?
Right.
This goes back to Justice Ginsburg's concerns about
right. you know,
chaos and instability.
Yeah. I can see why courts would be, like, hesitant to yeah. trigger a massive jurisdictional earthquake.
Exactly.
Okay. What's the final piece of the puzzle?
The fourth factor is whether there are other paths to achieving the tribe's goals. Could they, for example, use the federal land into trust process
okay.
instead of trying to reassert sovereignty directly?
Hold on. What is the land into trust process?
Sure.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's a process where tribes can petition the federal government,
right.
specifically the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to take land into trust on their behalf.
So instead of going to court and trying to, you know,
yeah.
revive their sovereignty,
right.
they could ask the federal government to, like, hold the land for them.
Exactly. And while the Sherrill case doesn't explicitly say so,
okay.
it definitely encourages tribes to go this route
right.
rather than relying on market purchases to reassert their sovereignty.
So is the court basically saying,
yeah.
look, we get it. You have goals,
mm.
but here's a less disruptive way to achieve them.
That's a really insightful way to put it.
And yeah.
it's crucial to understand that these four factors
yeah.
aren't meant to be a rigid test.
Right.
They're more like guidelines for courts to use when weighing these very complex issues.
Yeah.
But taken together,
mm-hmm.
they do tilt the scales towards local governments
yeah.
when jurisdiction has been in place for a long time.
So buying back land doesn't automatically mean you get to rule it.
Right.
Especially if you haven't actively asserted sovereignty
exactly.
for a while.
Yeah. So it yeah. really does complicate things.
It absolutely does. And the Sherrill case is a perfect illustration of that.
Yeah.
It forces us to confront the tension between
right.
historical claims
mm.
and present day realities.
Right.
And sometimes those two yeah. things clash in the legal arena.
All right. Let's recap what we've learned so far.
Okay.
A tribe's historical claim to land,
mm-hmm.
even if they legally buy it back,
yeah.
isn't enough to automatically revive their sovereignty.
Right.
The Supreme Court made it clear that time is a major factor.
It is.
And they laid out some guidelines for how courts should, you know,
yeah.
approach these cases in the future.
But there's one big question that's been bugging me
right.
throughout this whole discussion. If the Supreme Court is basically saying, tribes, you need to go through Congress or the Bureau of Indian Affairs to get your land back. Doesn't that kind of undermine the whole idea of, like, inherent tribal sovereignty?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's something legal scholars and tribal advocates are still debating.
Yeah.
On the one hand, the Sherrill decision seems to prioritize stability and the status quo
right.
over what many see as, you know, fundamental tribal rights.
It almost feels like it's saying, like, yeah, you have sovereignty.
Right.
But only if you follow our rules and jump through our hoops.
I understand that concern.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember that the land into trust process, while it can be effective,
right.
is also notoriously slow and bureaucratic.
Yeah.
It can take years, even decades,
wow.
for a tribe to get land placed into trust.
So it's not a quick or easy solution.
No.
And it still forces tribes to go to the federal government.
Yeah.
Which historically hasn't always had the best track record
right.
when it comes to honoring their commitments to tribal nations.
You're right. The history of federal Indian policy is full of broken treaties and injustices.
Yeah.
And some see the Sherrill decision as just another chapter in that long and troubled story.
So where does this leave us? What's
yeah.
the takeaway for, like, tribes, for local governments, for anyone trying to make sense of this incredibly complex issue?
I think the Sherrill case really underscores a few crucial points. For tribes, it's a reminder that even fundamental rights, like sovereignty,
yeah.
are affected by the realities of time and legal precedent.
Okay.
It also highlights the importance of being proactive and asserting those rights and exploring all the legal avenues available, including the land into trust process.
So don't wait 200 years to make your claim.
Right.
And be prepared to navigate a complicated legal system.
Exactly. Right. For local governments, Cheryl offers some reassurance that long-established jurisdictional boundaries won't be easily overturned, right, even when historical tribal claims are involved.
Stability over historical claims.
Yeah.
But does this mean that tribal sovereignty is essentially a lost cause if too much time has passed?
Not necessarily. The Cheryl decision doesn't completely shut the door on tribes reclaiming sovereignty over lost lands.
Right.
But it definitely makes it more challenging and forces tribes to be strategic and persistent.
So it's an uphill battle.
Yeah.
But not an impossible one.
That's a great way to put it.
Right.
And remember, the law is constantly evolving.
Right.
There are always new cases, new interpretations, new legal challenges that could shift the landscape of tribal sovereignty in the future.
This conversation is far from over.
Mm-hmm.
The City of Cheryl v. Oneida, an Indian Nation case, might have thrown a wrench into things.
Yeah.
But the pursuit of tribal sovereignty continues.
Absolutely. And the outcome of that pursuit will depend on many factors. Legal strategies, political will, public awareness.
Right.
And maybe most importantly, the unwavering determination of tribal nations to reclaim their rightful place.
That's a powerful thought to end on. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
To all our listeners out there, we encourage you to, you know, keep exploring this complex and fascinating area of law.
It is fascinating.
What are your thoughts on the Cheryl case? Was it a fair compromise or a setback for tribal rights? We'd love to hear your perspectives. Until next time, keep learning and keep diving deep.